So welcome back to Lungcast, the monthly respiratory health podcast series from the American Lung Association and medical news site HCP Live. I'm your host, Dr. Albert Rizzo, Chief Medical Officer of the American Lung Association. Before we introduce our guest today, just a reminder that Lungcast is available on all your favorite streaming platforms. You can subscribe to @Lungcast on YouTube to get new and archived episodes, as well as interview segments and episode highlights as they come out. A link to the show page, as well as the American Lung Association and HCPLive.com homepages for Lungcast, can be found in each episode description. And for those of you who prefer a podcast, you can subscribe to Lungcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and your favorite listening platforms. You can also register for more respiratory news and insights at both lung.org and HCPLive.com. Today's guest is Dr. Thomas Feil, who is the Distinguished Physician of the Infectious Disease Division and the Antimicrobial Stewardship Program at Summa Health in Akron, Ohio. He is also Professor Emeritus of Medicine and Master Teacher of the Infectious Disease Section of the Northeast Ohio Medical University. His research interests include randomized clinical trials for safety and efficacy of new antimicrobials, community-acquired pneumonia, and the impact of new diagnostics and antimicrobial stewardship on patient outcomes. He's very involved in the antimicrobial stewardship. Dr. Feil has been active in the Infectious Disease Society of America throughout his career, having been president of the society and serving on several committees. He was also chair of the Practice Guidelines Committee from 2005 through 2008, and a member of the board of the IDSA from 2008 through 11 and 2017 to 2022. Thank you for joining me today, Dr. Feil.
Well, hi, Dr. Rizzo. It's certainly a pleasure to be with you, and I thank you for inviting me to join this podcast.
Thank you. I'm glad you're here. I believe the most recent guidelines on the diagnosis and treatment of community-acquired pneumonia were put out by the American Thoracic Society and the Infectious Disease Association back in 2019. And at that time, they updated several recommendations from the 2007 guidelines almost 12 years earlier. I hope we can highlight some of those changes during our discussion today. Since the guidelines were published in 2019, I believe you were part of a multidisciplinary group consisting of 12 individuals selected for their clinical expertise in antimicrobial stewardship and infectious diseases, and have helped develop an updated clinical pathway that was finalized this past September in 2023. I believe there were several sections in that update. The first was the criteria for defining the severity of community-acquired pneumonia. Now, does the updated guideline use prediction tools similar to those used in the past, such as the Pneumonia Severity Index or the CURB 65? And can you comment on the current criteria in the update and their utility if there are times when one tool may be better than the other?
Yeah, well, first of all, Dr. Rizzo, let me just explain that this update, this clinical pathway that you refer to, was developed by IDSA with the support from CDC. And the primary purpose was to apply good antimicrobial stewardship principles to the most recent ATS-IDSA guidelines that, as you said, were published in 2019. And we also added some daily recommendations for management rather than just for initial evaluation. So it's a little bit unique from that aspect, that clinical pathway. But now to go to your specific question, both the ATS-IDSA guideline as well as that clinical pathway use the decision analysis tools to which you mentioned for severity of infection to help decide on site of care. And the pathway that specifically was used in the clinical pathway was the CURB 65, which you mentioned, which, as you know, is an acronym. And the C stands for confusion, the U for urea or BUN, R for respiratory rate, which is 30 or greater, a B for blood pressure, less than 90 systolic. You'd get a point for each of these, and then age 65 or older. And generally, if you have two of these five, it would be recommended you come into the hospital for optimal management. And I say that because that clinical pathway deals primarily with patients who are admitted to the hospital. The other tool that you mentioned, the PSI, Pneumonia Severity Index score, it's more comprehensive, in some ways more accurate, and we actually use that in our clinical trials to stratify our patients, but it does require evaluation of potentially 20 different aspects of the patient. So it is a bit more comprehensive. That's why in clinical practice, it's just more feasible to use that CURB 65.
Makes perfect sense. That's great. Now, another section of the update dealt with diagnostic tools. Can you please address the diagnostic tools that are discussed in the update algorithm? And I suspect some of these have changed because of the pandemic and the increased availability of PCR testing.
Well, yes, actually, from my perspective, I think one of the most significant advances recently has been the development of these rapid molecular tests that allow us identification of a potential pathogen literally within hours, and therefore can allow us a pathogen-directed management of these patients. And we do suggest that in that clinical pathway that if institutions have this available, we recommend to use it. Now, I have to acknowledge this is an enhancement to the ATS-IDSA guideline because that guideline was obviously published pre-pandemic. And I think we've learned a lot from the COVID pandemic. One of them is the awareness that of monomicrobial viral infections being an important cause of patients who, at least adults, who are admitted to the hospital with community-acquired pneumonia. Maybe 25-30% of patients now that we have these molecular tests, we're identifying viruses as the sole cause. And it's not just SARS-CoV-2 or influenza for which we have effective antiviral therapy. It's other viruses like human metapneumovirus, like adenovirus, respiratory syncytial virus. And indeed, if we have one of these tests that's positive for one of these viruses and we don't have evidence of a bacterial co-infection and the patient's doing well, we feel very comfortable stopping antibacterial therapy. And this is a big change because in the past, we usually did empiric antimicrobial therapy directed almost at all of the likely pathogens. And over the last several decades, this has led to over what I would consider overuse of empiric antibiotics that are broad spectrum because, looking at routine culture methods, you know, it was only the minority of patients even coming into the hospital we were able to identify a pathogen. But with these multiplex panels now, we're able to significantly increase the yield of the pathogens, including the core pathogens like pneumococcus, Haemophilus, the organisms associated with atypical pneumonia. So these results can allow us to narrow therapy more specifically. And this is really good for antimicrobial stewardship because with more narrowed therapy, we tend to disrupt the normal genome less, okay? And that can lead to less adverse events, less such as C. diff, and less resistance. And actually, as I point out to my colleagues and my patients, I mean, a normal or at least a healthy microbiome is extremely important to keep patients healthy because it's really important in maintaining a good immune system, okay? So having said that, you know, I acknowledge that there are some considerations or concerns about these newer molecular tests. I mean, one of them is, they're very sensitive. So are we identifying just organisms that are colonizing the patient, the upper respiratory tract, versus true pathogens? But I think as we get more information, more experience, that we'll be able to interpret these tests very accurately. And actually, in doing so, in general, what we found is that it generally leads to less expensive antibiotics and actually less duration of antibiotics.
So it sounds like you're a big fan of the PCR tools and the further development and use. It's great. Right. I'd also like your opinion on another test, the use and the timing of a procalcitonin level. We know that several biomarkers exist for detecting infections, such as white blood cell count, C-reactive protein, SED rates, and the procalcitonin has been a significant part of the evaluations of the past decade to become a high negative predictive value for bacterial infections. And consequently, I believe it's emerged as a good tool, as you say, for antibiotic stewardship, as other things have been, aiding in the reduction of the inadvertent antibiotic administration. Any further comments on the procalcitonin levels?
Yes. Actually, I'm a very strong supporter of the use of the procalcitonin as a biomarker to assess the status of a patient and the clinical course of a patient. And as you know, the procalcitonin is specific for being elevated in systemic bacterial infections because of certain cytokines that are produced in bacterial infections. And also, it's actually decreased in viral infections also because of specific cytokines associated with viral infections. But what makes it very helpful and useful is that it's timely response to the infection. So with an onset of active bacterial infection, it will rise quite rapidly. And I'm talking about within 4 to 6 hours. But similarly, if we're giving appropriate antibiotics, we can see a significant decrease with an hour. So we can follow the course. And what we found is that that's been very helpful in being able to make the decision about stopping antibiotics, because there's good information and good data of certain thresholds. And one of the findings is that if you have a peak procalcitonin and you see a drop by more than 80%, there's good evidence that we could stop antibiotics because the infection is controlled. But I have to say, I mean, none of these tests are absolute. And with the procalcitonin, there are some false positives that can occur. For example, patients who are in hemorrhagic shock or have kidney injury can elevate without maybe significant infection. And also certain bacteria such as mycoplasma may not elevate the procalcitonin. So in certain instances, it may not be that helpful. So we use this test as a supplement to our clinical judgment as to, you know, when we could stop antibiotics. And we've performed several studies in our institution and have found that it's been very valuable in being able to reduce the length of stay and promote better antimicrobial use with this test.
Right. Good caveats there about the procalcitonin level. The other section of this pathway that we've talked about is the important treatment algorithm that was devised. Can you kind of walk us through that algorithm, noting the distinction between the sites of care that you talked about regarding severity, and also noting that the algorithms are heavily based on whether or not MRSA or Pseudomonas are part of the consideration in the differential diagnosis? Can you walk us through that?
Yeah, sure. Actually, in this pathway, I mean, for empiric antimicrobial therapy, we certainly target the core pathogens such as Pneumococcus, Haemophilus, you know, the organisms associated with atypical pneumonia. But as you said, we also indicate the need to assess for risk factors for MRSA, risk factors for Pseudomonas and other more resistant, you know, pathogens. And since this updated pathway focuses on patients that are admitted to the hospital, once that decision has been made, then we need to make the decision, is a patient sick enough to have severe community acquired pneumonia that warrants admission to the ICU. And that's important because we do address these risks somewhat differently and as far as addressing empiric antimicrobial therapy. So if a patient, for example, is admitted to the general ward, we have specific risks for MRSA or Pseudomonas that are a little bit different than for a severe community acquired pneumonia. And the rationale for that is that the risk of inadequate empiric antibiotic therapy for clinical outcome is much greater in severe community-acquired pneumonia. So we're much more likely to at least empirically cover these pathogens until we get the results of some clinical study. So for the non-severe patient going to the general ward, the risk for MRSA is listed in the pathway is a prior culture positive for MRSA. Whereas for severe CAP, that those going to the ICU, it would be, in addition, anybody who was previously hospitalized. Thus, it's more likely that we're going to use anti-MRSA therapy in these ICU patients, and the usual options are going to be vancomycin or linezolid. However, we do note that if one does a nasal swab PCR for MRSA and it's negative, that's a strong negative prediction against the presence of MRSA pneumonia. So if you have that test and it's negative, we feel very comfortable of stopping anti-MRSA therapy. Now, similarly for Pseudomonas, there's somewhat of a different nuance concerning non-severe and severe or ICU pneumonia. So For non-severe, we consider a risk factor for Pseudomonas as somebody who has very advanced lung disease or bronchiectasis, for example, or a history of a Pseudomonas infection within the past year. But for patients coming to the ICU, risks also include anybody who's been hospitalized or who's been on parenteral antibiotics in the last 3 months, okay? So if there's no risk for MRSA or Pseudomonas, and that's certainly going to be the case for most patients admitted to the general ward, then the recommendation is for empiric therapy to cover these core pathogens that I mentioned, and it's generally going to be a beta-lactam plus a macrolide. And the most common beta-lactam that I think that's used in most institutions like ours is ceftriaxone, and then we'll often use azithromycin, you know, to cover the atypical pathogens. Then the other option for the general ward patients is a respiratory fluoroquinolone, such as levofloxacin or moxifloxacin. However, from an antimicrobial stewardship standpoint, I can tell you that many of us prefer to avoid the fluoroquinolones due to the adverse effects associated with their use. Now, if there's Pseudomonas risk factors, we certainly want to use an anti-pseudomonal beta-lactam, which will also cover the pneumococcus and the Haemophilus, such as piperacillin tazobactam, such as cefepime. But then we're also going to add a drug active against the atypical pathogens. But I want to go back to the ATS-IDSA guideline, because you mentioned there's changes from the 2007 version. Right. And one of the big changes is that since 2007, now up to 2019, there's been a significant increase in resistance of pneumococcus to the macrolides. Because in the old guidelines, it was suggested, particularly for outpatients, you could use monotherapy with a macrolide. But we no longer recommend that anymore, because all over, at least in the United States, because there's significant resistance. So now it's recommended for outpatients, if you don't have any significant risk factors, such as risk for resistance or have significant underlying condition, what's recommended in the new ATS-IDSA guidelines is you can use monotherapy with amoxicillin, monotherapy with doxycycline. Personally, I prefer doxycycline because it covers the atypical pathogens as well. And then if you do have significant underlying conditions, we would recommend a combination of oral agents such as amoxicillin or amoxiclav plus azithromycin.
Yeah, and again, these algorithms, a lot of this is based on immunocompetency versus compromised individuals with regard to their immune system.
That's very important to distinguish. These are immunocompetent patients who are free living in the community. It's not patients who have significant underlying immunodeficiency type of issues, right, for which we're much more broad spectrum, have to cover other significant pathogens, opportunistic infections, fungi, et cetera.
Right. Thank you. So let's stay with the antibiotic stewardship a little bit more. The aspect of appropriate use of the antibiotics is significant with regard to not only the side effects avoidance, but also the promotion of resistance. Can you go through some of the best practices regarding duration of antibiotic therapy with regard to stewardship? You've touched on some of them.
Yeah, right. Well, one of the unique aspects of this pathway, and I mentioned it earlier, is that we actually give recommendations on a day-to-day basis of management, not just the initial evaluation, such that as you evaluate the results of lab tests and cultures and evaluate the progress of the patient, and maybe you identify a pathogen, then it's really important to de-escalate from your empiric antimicrobial therapy to a less broad spectrum therapy. And as I said previously, this is very important for antimicrobial stewardship. We also provide guidance, for example, on when it's appropriate to transition from IV to oral therapy, and then when it's reasonable to discharge a patient to outpatient care. And then finally, to answer your last question there about duration, we do give recommendations of duration of therapy. And this has changed quite a bit in the last two or three decades, where we can recall, I think, that it was very common to treat for 2 weeks with antibiotics, even if patients were doing well. Well, now there's good information and evidence, randomized clinical trials, et cetera, to show that if a patient, particularly, let's say, a patient in the general floor, if they're doing well and they've reached clinical stability by 72 hours, day three, that maybe that's all you need, that day three, the 3 to 5 days can be quite adequate for duration of therapy for these patients. So I think this is a significant change that indicates that we don't have to treat as long as we did before, as long as the patients are doing well.
Right. With future speculation, do you see any changes in the therapy for community-acquired pneumonia based on new therapeutics that may be on the horizon, new antimicrobials?
Yeah, right. I always think it's important for us to have new antimicrobial agents available, if for no other reason, just to reduce the pressure on the standard options that we have, to have more options available. And there's always going to be some patients who, for some reason, cannot tolerate beta-lactams, have problems with macrolides or even the fluoroquinolones. And there are a couple of new agents that have been approved by the FDA, have been well-studied, and are available for community-acquired pneumonia that cover all the key pathogens. And I'm naming two. One is lofamulin, and the other is omadacycline. Both of these are available IV and oral. However, lofamulin is not presently available, but these are two additional options where one would be, certainly available to us now, and that's omadacycline. But in addition to newer antibiotics, there's much interest in looking at other therapeutic directions. I mean, for example, modulating the host response. And there's significant information over the last year, actually, about the use and the benefit of steroids, glucocorticoids, in patients who have severe pneumonia associated with better outcomes, including mortality. And then there's also interest of targeting specific virulence factors of pathogens that might be of interest in the future.
So switching gears a little bit, we know that the important role of the healthcare provider is certainly to treat, but also to prevent diseases when possible. Today's clinician is now armed with several vaccines that could help prevent the development of respiratory infections or community-acquired pneumonia. And among them, you've mentioned, pneumococcal, but we also have influenza now, RSV, and COVID vaccines. Could you just kind of hit high-level review of the current recommendations from the ACIP regarding the use of these vaccines?
Yeah, well, first of all, let me just say that all these mentioned vaccines are disease-preventing and potentially life-threatening, particularly in patients that have underlying lung disease. And certainly I recommend to all patients for whom these are indicated that they should receive them. Now, the problem is we know lately that there's been an issue with vaccine hesitancy and the anti-vaccine considerations, much of which is false, as we know. But the best way for our patients to receive these vaccines, to accept the vaccines, is for us as caregivers to give strong recommendations about their use, because we know that that's the most motivating factor for patients to receive the vaccine, if their care provider gives a strong recommendation. So having said that, let me just say, rather than going to specific recommendations with each of those vaccines, because it's quite variable based on several factors,
right,
I just prefer to refer our listeners to go to CDC, the ACIP recommendations. CDC regularly gives recommendations in chart form based on age, based on underlying condition, which are relatively easy to follow. And they provide guidance on how to administer, when to administer, should a booster be given. So my advice is to stay tuned to these recommendations.
Right. Awareness is the most important thing. That's great, great advice. So I wanted to kind of close the interview on topics of a recent article you had in New England Journal of Medicine back in August of 2023. At the end of that article, you talk about some areas of uncertainty. And I was wondering if you could give us a few comments, particularly on those related to the lung microbiome, the evolving technology of PCR that you've talked about, and also the link between the community-acquired pneumonia and cardiovascular disease.
Yeah, all of those are very important. Let me just go through those one by one. I mean, as far as the role of the lung microbiome, I mean, we really need to know more about its role in health and in disease. I mean, we used to think that the lower respiratory tract, particularly the lungs, were devoid of microorganisms, but we now know there is actually a lung microbiome. And when we disrupt that, just like when we disrupt the gut and disease. And so I think we need more information here of how we can protect that and what its role is in lung infections. Now, secondly, I mentioned that we feel very strongly that these molecular tests, the PCR tests, are very helpful in our management of patients with community-acquired pneumonia and identifying a pathogen. But we need more studies to truly evaluate the clinical impact and the cost effectiveness. So we need more of that. And then lastly, you bring up a good point, Dr. Rizzo, about the association between community-acquired pneumonia and increased risk of cardiovascular disease. Again, we used to think that if a patient had pneumonia in the hospital and they developed an MI, well, it was unrelated. But now we know there is a relationship. And so we need further studies to gain a better understanding of this relationship so we can develop interventions maybe aimed at reducing this cardiovascular risk, as well as the risks of other sequelae of community-acquired pneumonia.
Right. So more research is needed. So this has been a brief but a comprehensive discussion for our listeners. Any other points you'd like to make at this time before we end the discussion?
Yeah. Thanks, Dr. Rizzo. Actually, following up on that last statement about the long-term sequelae, I mean, this is something now that's a different perspective. I mean, we used to think of pneumonia as an acute process, right? You got over it and that was it. But now we know there are both short-term and long-term consequences, and that this is a systemic type of infection. And that, as I said, with the cardiovascular risk, we need to be able to understand better how we can intervene to, and the better we know about how to manage this and how to prevent it, it's going to be better for our patients.
Well, thank you again to Dr. Feil for your time and sharing of your expertise. If you want to hear more regarding respiratory infections, we have developed a great archive of discussions on our show feeds, including episode 37 with Dr. Barbara Taylor regarding the RSV transmission and the new vaccines, as well as episode 17 with Dr. Shantanu Agarwal regarding fending off influenza. Be sure to subscribe and rate Lungcast on your preferred listening or watching platform, and visit lung.org and hcplive.com for more news and resources. Also, please keep in mind that aside from educational endeavors such as this podcast, the American Lung Association, through its Research Institute, is a source of funding for researchers in all aspects of lung disease. More information on this can be obtained at lung.org/research. Until next time, I'm Dr. Albert Rizzo reminding you that if you can't breathe, nothing else matters.